Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, no matter where you're listening, around the world, this is Sedona Talk Radio.
Join Irma Francis as she explores the transformation from adulthood to soulhood. Having achieved the life goals of adulthood and met the expectations of family and society, we may feel like there is something missing. This something could be a direct contact with our soul. It is through soul contact that we become ready to let go of the conditioned self and allow our true self to step forward and take the lead. We shift into a deep and compassionate soulhood, connecting us to our divinity as well as our humanity. Irma Francis opens a portal to the exploration of soulhood by inviting open-ended inquiries into this eternal dimension.
Hello, and welcome to Adulthood to Soulhood. This is Irma Francis. I'm joined this evening by Ernie Vecchio, psychologist, spiritual teacher, author of The Soul's Intent, and host of The Soul's Intent Talk Show. Our show tonight is A Pathway to Wholeness, Breakdown, Breakthrough, Integrate. All that is false begins to break down, sometimes piece by piece, or sometimes by hitting some sort of bottom. Whatever we have been hiding behind stops working, and try as we might, we cannot continue the sham. All the false images we have created start to give way and disintegrate right before our eyes. We may be feeling a bit dazed and confused, like we are neither here nor there. We are no longer clinging to the past and its conditioning, but we are not quite fully present either. Then another shift happens. We begin our journey into new territory, a breakthrough to another side of life not previously known to us. We begin to surrender to an integration of our divine self with our human self. Our personality aligns with our soul. The pretense is over, and we are now connected to our true self. We are whole. We are no longer trying to find the missing pieces of ourselves in the external world. So that's our topic tonight, and welcome, Ernie. How are you?
Hey, Irma. It's great to be here. You sound a little like you're talking away from the microphone, so I'll just let you know that up front. It's muffled just a little bit, but it's
okay.
Wonderful to be here, and yeah, it's wonderful to be here, and this is a great topic.
It is. There's so much I want to cover tonight. As I read that, I was thinking towards the end, wouldn't it be nice if it was that simple?
Yeah.
Oh, just, yeah, but it's not. It's not.
Well,
I thought it would
what,
be.
What I love. Go ahead. You start. Go ahead. And we seem to have a delay, and it's always on my end. We have a little bit of a delay in the connection.
Okay. Well, I thought it might be nice to start out by talking about wholeness and defining that. I know when I think about wholeness, it's kind of simple. In the spiritual arena, it's, you know, the alignment of body, mind, and spirit. And to me, it's that alignment of body, mind, and spirit and being connected to something higher than the conditioned self, which I would call God or Source. And it's through that connection, for me personally, that's the only way I can reach a place of wholeness is to connect to that source. What would your definition be, Irma?
Well, that has changed over time for me, Irma. I when I first started out in my profession, I would have said that wholeness was just being some authentic version of yourself and not faking anything, you know, being as real as you possibly can be. But now, with some time and some depth to it, I see it as an integration process of just just a series of deaths and rebirths of old identities and old ways of thinking and old ways of perceiving, and letting go, and then reintegrating just over and over again until you get to that place. And of course, in my work, I talk about soul, spirit, ego, and heart as a as four kind of elements or constructs in the human condition that are that have a symbiotic relationship and that are communicating with one another. That certainly is another way to define wholeness, is the complete communication of those four qualities in the human experience. And when you consider that we're only using one or two of those in any given time. So that's changed for me in terms of that. It'll probably change again in another 6 months to how I, what I think about wholeness.
But I love the way being connected. You put that
Which part?
how you take the heart and the soul and how you break all of that and bring it all together.
Yeah. It's well, and it's what I've done is I've looked over time of just what is this communication that is happening between us in the outside world, but also what's happening inside of us. What are these communicative kind of devices, if you will? How are they communicating? Why are they communicating? And where's the signal coming from? I mean, these are the kind of questions that I would sit around and play with in my head. And how would I talk about that in a way that makes sense to people? And so, you know, we're all connected to all of this. We're all connected to life in some way. And certainly my perception of wholeness would be to have a full connection to that. That thing we can't see, that's something that's guiding us, and it's inside and outside of us. So yeah, so that changes. That changes with me over time.
Yeah, and I like how you talked about the ego being not so much like a balloon that's inflated, but more like an onion with layers and layers. And when you were giving your definition of wholeness, that's what I was imagining, getting to the core of that onion. Me would be a place of wholeness. I don't know if we ever actually get there and stay there, but
well, certainly in the way that, you know, in the way that we talk about it spiritually, we come into that onion, comes into the world already whole, and it doesn't have any layers between it and the outside world. So the layers are really what we call, you know, the ego, and we put on the defenses and the ego to adapt to our world and to our lives. And so it's almost like we're taking those layers off to get down to that authentic core, which would be wholeness. And so it's confusing, because if we're already whole, then why are we in so much pain? If we're already whole, if we don't lack anything, then why do we feel like we do? And so that's part of the problem, is that we already have everything we need, and we're already complete. And so the problem is that we leave it to the ego for the interpretation. That's the problem. It's the ego that sees itself is detached and disconnected, and so because it's only one of those many layers.
Yeah. And as I'm listening to you, I'm thinking, you know, another word for me for wholeness would be pitana, how you described it, is that, you know, we're born whole. It's not, you know, it's our natural. It's our natural state. So another word for wholeness would be natural. It's natural.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, it's almost like, and we've talked about this, I think, off the air before, but it's almost like the word alone. You know, we think when you think of wholeness, you think of its opposite, which would be incomplete or lacking. When you think of alone, you think of it being isolating, and when in actuality, alone comes from two words, which means all one. So wholeness implies that we're moving from some incomplete place to a complete place, when really we're already complete.
Yeah.
It's the disintegration. Yeah. It's the disintegration that we struggle with. We don't understand how we got to where we are. Feeling detached and disconnected from that core self, and so the ego would frame it is is lacking wholeness or lacking something.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, all I have to go by is the culture that I was raised in. But sometimes I do wonder, if I was raised in a different culture with different values, would the struggle for maybe a return to wholeness, I would say, would that have been such a struggle? You know, what if I was born in an island somewhere where everything was kind of natural and there wasn't the value yeah. system of the materialism and consumerism in that we have in this culture? I wonder if the struggle would be the same. Yeah.
I think the remembering and dismembering would still happen. It may not be as severe or as traumatic because the human ego is a survival instinct. It's a survival construct. So even if you were on an island and in a culture that didn't have all of the stuff that we deal with, you still would have to deal with the expectations of the family, expectations of the culture, fulfill your role as a person, as a human being, and you'd have to follow a vocation, you'd have to worship and believe whatever it is that everybody's believing in. And at some point, as you go through all the adaptive phases of that, that innocent, authentic, curious version gets put away. And so I think it still happens. It just isn't as severe or as dramatic, maybe. But what may be working in your advantage in that same place, though, is you wouldn't be as worried about reconnecting with it. Maybe the reconnection would be easier.
Yeah.
Because it's temporary anyway. Yeah, it's temporary anyway to get detached from oneself and then to get back to that. It's only in cultures like the one that we live in where it seems permanent.
I think our disconnection from nature plays a big part in that. That being such a big struggle. I know being raised in Chicago, I was surrounded by cement, but my soul just craved any little piece of nature I could find because I connected to it because I recognized that I was the same and that natural state of being, that kind of unbrokenness. There's no not being severed from source. And so that was one way I connected, But what
I was just going to say, cultures that are connected to the earth in that way stay connected. They don't have the same problems we do in the West, so to speak.
Yeah. And I am part Cherokee, so I think my Native American ancestors were helping me out there. I definitely felt
there. You go.
So what I did for tonight's show, Ernie, because it was such a good match, there's a book that I read, years and years ago, and it kind of just came up in connection with this show, and I thought I would use it as kind of an outline for our discussion tonight, and the name of that book is called The Five Stages of the Soul by Harry Moody and David Carroll. Have you heard of the book?
I have heard of the book, yes.
Oh, it's one of my all-time favorites. So I thought we could take those five stages that they talk about in the book and go over each of them as our pathway to wholeness tonight. And the stages are the call, the search, the struggle, the breakthrough, and the return. Thought we could go over each one and have a discussion around each. The first one, the call, I just copied a little bit out of the book. We begin to recognize that something is missing in our lives and that something is our lost self, a self that for whatever reasons we felt like we had to repress. Usually around midlife, that repression becomes more difficult and we start to feel a pull or a call towards something, but we may not know what that something is. All of us are invited to participate in this self-transformation at some point in our lives. There is no guarantee that we will take advantage of the chance when it comes. Some people choose not to. While the invitation to the spiritual journey is a birthright, it is entirely our own choice whether or not we embark on the journey once we are called. So what do you think about the call, Ernie?
Well, the call is certainly a topic that is different for everybody that hears the call. You know, I say to people all the time that dream work has been an important part of the work that I have done. But dream work is a call, if you will, from the unconscious. And the more intense the dream, the louder the phone is ringing. That kind of call is happening all the time to us, that we are being communicated with by the soul in our sleeping lives, in our unconscious lives, and in ways that many of us don't pay a lot of attention to. And so that is one form of the call. The other thing that comes to mind as you're saying all that is as we've talked before off the air, is the vertical relationship with some higher power and feeling the tug of that relationship. Mm-hmm. We don't always, I say a lot of the times on my own show that we know what's driving us, but we don't have any clue what's pulling us. And having a sense of that, what that pull is also related to the call. Mm-hmm. But you also said that it's around midlife, and that's very valid, that we're not even going to pay attention to the phone ringing. We're not going to pay attention to the tug until we begin to realize the missing piece or get the sensation that something's missing. So, yeah, that's very valid.
Yeah.
But not everybody...
And that's hard for me to imagine, because that call is so strong in me. There's no way I could have not answered. There's no way, because there was something in me that... And when I look at the word, the call, I'm actually thinking of like a telephone call, a connection.
Yeah.
A connection. Mm-hmm. And for me, that's what the call is. And I know when I am connected, where, you know, I've got a strong connection. And when I don't, have that strong connection, my creativity starts to dwindle away. My energy level goes down. I am actually offline. Feel that. And so I do my spiritual practices to get me back online, to get me back connected. So I'm looking at that a little bit from a little bit of a different angle, I think. But
yeah, and it's and the trap is that a lot of people, when they feel the call, if they're fortunate enough to have the sensation of it, they don't know how to keep the ego out of the equation. And so they go out and get a new job or a new spouse or a new car. So in other words, it's part of that. It's part of the angst that the human spirit is playing a part in that. The call is happening from the soul's perspective, but the soul's never off. It's always on. It's never away. It's always here. It's always there and available to us. So why are we paying attention to the call now? And this is what the ego would do. I mean, the ego would say that angst has always been there. Just get a new car, get a new job, change locations, whatever. And if you don't understand that the ego is going to try to distract you away from that, then you're not going to hear the call. And I think that if you don't think your life has purpose or meaning, you may or may not hear the call. The ego really gets in the way of people hearing that. It's almost like saying that you have a gift that you want to manifest and bring to the world, and then the ego says, that's not that big a deal. Just put it away. Just put it away. That's almost what it's like. And if you can't ward that off, if you cannot say, bull, that's just bull, I'm not going to listen to the ego on that one. And that's where the heart comes in. The heart, mm-hmm. the heart is for the conviction. He gets in and says, wait a minute, when I turn myself in this particular direction, my needle is pointing right at the call. And I'm going to go where the gravitational force is pulling me, and I'm not going to listen to the ego. So that's why I'm saying that it's you've got to have some communication, some relationship with your inner life and your inner self to actually acknowledge that the call is the call. Right. The ego and will. That, I think the ego will just. I think the ego will just call it noise. You know, at some point, for a lot of people.
And that you know, angst. Yes. That angst that we feel. I mean, it can go either direction. That angst can addictions can be born from that angst. To try and ease it, but also that angst can be the wake-up call. So it's like we always have a choice. We can go either way. And to me, it's like, when I'm not answering that call and I'm not connected and I'm not online, I feel a sense of dis-ease. And that is so uncomfortable to me. I can feel it in every cell of my being. And so I will do whatever it takes. Even creative writing to me is a spiritual practice to get back online so that I have peace.
wouldn't you agree, Irma, that it's a tuning process to prepare yourself for the call when it arrives? In other words, if you can imagine that your life experiences and all the things that you're doing are preparing you and somehow tuning your instrument that is your divine character, tuning that instrument so that when the call arrives that you will recognize it and hear it. And people don't see that, but your life is is shaping you like a piece of clay to turn you into an instrument that will hear the call when it comes. If people could take that approach to their lives, that whatever's happening to them is shaping them and fine tuning them to be able to receive this sense of presence, this gift of presence, because that's what it is. It's grace. It's it's divine favor that literally comes through. That comes through when you least expect it. I had a very good friend who was a Catholic nun describe grace to me one time as being like a fish in water that a fish doesn't realize that it's buoyant, that the water is above it and below it and to left or right of it. And she kind of saw grace that way, that grace keeps us buoyant. If the fish had an ego, it would sink to the bottom of the ocean. It doesn't realize that it literally is existing in that space and buoyant in that space because it is surrounded by grace. And the ego is not interfering with that. So yeah. I wish
that's,
it was
that's
as easy
very
as,
beautiful the way you put that, Ernie. That was very beautiful.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Oh, and it feels valid, doesn't it?
absolutely.
I mean, why do we love animals so much is because they don't have egos.
Yeah,
they don't really have any. It gets in the way of their naturalness. Yeah.
I know. For me, I love the word grace, and I understand the feeling of grace. I feel very blessed that at a very young age I experienced grace. So that experience was so profound for me that when I get off course, I can always find my way back to grace. And there's nothing more fulfilling in life because everything is embraced in grace. You have everything. and so there is no seeking. There's just, a being in a place of grace and love. And I'm not always there, but I know what it feels like, so I can find my way back. And I feel very blessed by that.
Yeah. Makes me think of that Dan Fogelberg song. I think it was Dan Fogelberg. They say that grace is jealous. No, they say that love is jealous. They say that love is blind. They say that love is always in a hurry. But the face of love is forgiving, and the grace of love is kind. In the face of love is kind, and the grace of love is there for everyone to find. And so I didn't really have a sense of what grace was until I was literally swimming in it like a fish. And I couldn't deny it. I couldn't deny that it was that somehow, and I just couldn't handle the definition of divine favor that's undeserving, because my the shame that I grew up with wouldn't allow me to feel grace, experience grace, or even accept that grace was something that was possible. But now that I understand what it is, and again, it's another word. You hear me play with words a lot, but love and truth and freedom is of the same dimension that grace is in. So they're all kind of So they're really kind of dimensional words, or they're words that's talking about the same dimension. So it's almost like a sensation. Grace and love and truth and freedom are all sensation words of a singular dimension. And so you can enter that dimension through any one of those four doors, if you will. Grace was a hard one for me. Because I didn't think I was ever really going to, you know, when I heard the definition of it is, divine favor that's undeserving. I'm like, well, that's me. I'm certainly undeserving.
And the beautiful thing about grace and love and freedom, and I always miss the other one.
And truth. Yeah, truth.
And truth. I always miss truth.
Well, it's because people think of truth as information. Can't imagine the truth as a place. Information. Yeah.
And all of those in that dimension of being, it's not something you can assert yourself to have. It's something that you just have to let go and allow and realize it's already there and it's been there all the while.
Yeah, that's the key word, is allow.
Yeah.
That's the key word. And that's what that's what I say all the time when people always say, what do I do? What do I do? I said, well, my experience on this path is it's probably a bunch of stuff you need to stop doing. There's no doing involved. Mm-hmm. There's no action to be made. There is a perspective and a vantage point, a posture by which one enters these places, but it isn't a doing. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so now let's go on to the search. We respond to the call with the search. For most of us, the search begins with the quest for guidance. There is a universe of compelling paths to choose from. Once the search for a teaching is completed, a second type of search begins, seeking after the place within us where the spiritual impulse lives and grows. On a conscious level, the search is a quest for a spiritual practice that seems right for us. On a deeper level, what we are really looking for is the secret something, not easily put into words, but that we sense is out there somewhere, someplace, waiting for us, calling to us. Interesting. That secret something. See, I don't think I ever felt that way. I never felt like it was something outside of me.
I was going to say for a lot of people, when you think of seeking, it is an external kind of process. When you actually, it takes some time and some maturity and some work to realize that it's an internal experience. But it makes you think of the swimmer that's swimming towards the beacon, and no matter how hard he swims, the beacon just keeps getting further and further away because he doesn't realize that he and the beacon are one and the same. So the very thing that you're seeking, you really already have. And if you leave it to the ego to put it outside of you and external, you'll never get there. So it's an internal road less traveled kind of thing that we've talked about before. It's the inner journey that is where the real seeking begins. Just like I say all the time, it's not even answers that we're searching for. It's better questions. Mm-hmm. And
if we,
so many people
if
think
we
it's
only
the
knew, yeah.
If we,
if
only,
we
knew,
only knew that the present was not to be found outside, it's inside of us. And maybe that's why it seems so hard to find, because we're not looking inside.
Right. Well, and we don't know how to do that. We're not taught how to do that. And the same way we're not taught how to suffer. We're taught how to avoid suffering. We're not taught how to be with the suffering. So there's so much of this work we're not taught how to do, and so we're all kind of flying by the seat of our pants until we have an experience with it. And then when we have the experience and we know that it's real, nobody can argue us away from the realness of what we just experienced, but we also can't explain it. We don't always know how or why it happened. We just know it was real. So it's kind of like, okay, I'm onto something. You know, that's what we end up saying to her. I'm onto something here. This is huge. And but I can't, how do I talk about it? Who do I tell, you know? And that's really kind of what it feels like.
So the struggle and suffering are kind of the same thing.
Yeah, I think at least for me personally, in my personal life and certainly in my professional life, I've grown to appreciate that without the angst, without the prodding, the emotional prodding of the human spirit to make the ego awaken, that we would not get here. So the idea of the adversity, whatever the adversity is to suffer the ego awake, because it isn't going to be talked awake. It isn't going to be tricked awake. It isn't going to be coaxed awake. It's got to be, like you're saying in your show tonight, it's got to break down first. You got to crack it like an egg before it's going to listen to you, before the ego is going to listen and respond. And so, yeah, unfortunately, that's the nature of it. But it isn't as scary as it all sounds when you begin to realize that it's part of a process.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm just thinking of all the people I know that try to avoid the suffering and avoid the struggle. And to me, and I was thinking about this today, it's that struggle and that suffering that creates the depth within us. I mean, If we don't know our own pain, how can we have empathy for the pain and the suffering of others? I don't think we would be able to.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, that's certainly how we learn compassion is beginning to stay with that. But you know, I may have told you this before, but I had a student one time ask me in a class that I act like and talk like there's a halfway place between everything, there's a middle ground. And so he challenged me and asked me what the halfway place was between winning and losing. And this fits the of this because I didn't have an answer right away. I had to go home and think about it. When I came back, I had him to tell me whether he was if he was a football fan and which team, and so I'll just kind of make up the team. Let's say that the Cleveland Browns are playing the Chicago Bears or whatever, and he was from Cleveland. And I said, well, what if the football team is winning 45-0 at halftime? How are you going to feel about that? He said, well, we're going to be happy and pleased. You know, our team is winning. What's going to be happening in the stands? He essentially said, well, people are going to be kind of bored. The game's a wash. He said, some folks are probably going to leave. I said, okay, flip the score and make the opposing team now up 45-0, and your team is losing. What's happening in the stands? He says, well, now we're sad, we're upset, we're angry. We definitely are probably going to leave because the game's a wash. I said, so what keeps you in the stadium? And he goes, what? And I said, what keeps you in the stands? And he didn't get the answer. And the answer is 14-7 or 10-3. It's the struggle that keeps you. And so people don't realize that life is a lot like that. That when you're struggling, it's really a call, if you will, that you are alive, that you are in this, that you don't have to pinch yourself to know that you're here because you're suffering to be here. And it's part of what that means. I think the myth that we sell in spiritual work and in mental health is to reach some place of incredible bliss and incredible enlightenment, and everything is just glorious. And the truth of the matter is the friction of the human condition continues in the same way that in just a month or so the leaves are going to go off the trees and it's going to be wintertime. And you can complain about that and complain about the cold and say it's depressing and everything is dead. But the truth is it's a time of dormancy, and it's a time of rest, and it's a time for rebirth in the spring. So it's a matter of how you approach this business of struggle, and how you see it to see its benefit. But I know of no way to get the ego to awaken than to hit it between the eyes and and say, wake up. And this is an existential issue anyway, you see, Irma. I mean, we are supposed to crack this container that we call the human condition at least 3 or 4 times in a lifetime and reinvent ourselves. If we don't do that, then spiritually we will become stagnant and we will be stuck. I say we become spiritually constipated. We're not flowing or moving in any way that is in sync with anything. And so that's the reason for the suffering. That's the reason for the suffering.
I really like that. I like that image that you just gave, because why would human beings be that much different than, say, a snake or other animals?
Right.
That I think a tarantula, they shed their skin because they've outgrown it and they need to move forward. It's old.
Right.
They don't need that anymore.
Right.
And they move forward. Why would human beings be any different?
Yeah, so we don't like it, because what we're talking about here is ego death. That's the breakdown, breakthrough. I mean, we have to undergo ego death to be born again.
Yeah.
And you know, I say on my show all the time that you think you're born when you that you got here when you were born. You don't get here till you choose to arrive. Well, if you're doing it developmentally, you're supposed to have about 4 or 5 arrivals, which means you're also supposed to have 4 or 5 deaths. And that death and rebirth process is what people run from and are afraid of and intimidates them, because they don't understand it's a cycle of evolution. It's a cycle of progress, that you're going to be better and more for it if you just allow it. If you fight it, it's going to be just horrendous.
Right. It's
I say
the
all
resistance.
The time, it's like it's I say all the time, I use the birth example. It'd be like somebody who's carried a child for 9 months and you decide to carry it for 10 months or 11 months or 12 months. You know, what happens if you extend labor? Oh my God, of course, it's horrible. What a horrible idea to extend a 9-month period and make it 12, 14, 15 months. How about years? Some people make it years. They don't allow themselves. They extend their labor for decades.
Yeah.
And wonder why they're miserable and why they're angry and why they feel disconnected and lost. And so these are natural processes, this business of arrival and this business of getting here. And it doesn't have to be scary, and it doesn't have to be overwhelmingly intimidating.
Yeah, again, to me, and I may be a little hung up on this, I admit it, but it's a natural process. And it's natural.
Yeah,
if you don't
up.
Fight it, I'm hung up on that. Yeah.
You're hung up on that, yeah.
Can't help it.
Well, you know what it is. You know what it is, Irma. You know what it is, and this is not. And I'm not picking on you to say it this way, but this is something that has come easy for you. And what I mean is, the natural part has come easy. What has not been easy for you is for people to tell you to stop being natural.
That's true.
It's the idea.
That's absolutely true.
It's almost like somebody said, "Stop being Irma," and you said, "Oh, okay, I don't want to, but okay." I mean. And,
how do I do that?
Wait a minute. Yeah, how do I stop being me? But I think those of us that have the gift, and really isn't this really the, aren't they the authors of all of our books? I mean, everybody that has a particular gift on this call, on this business of wholeness and breaking through and getting here and becoming integrated, everybody has their own little personal experience with it. And so they write their books and their take on it based upon their experience. And they make it sound easy because that was their gift. It isn't the gift of everybody.
Yeah,
it was their
that's
gift.
True. That's true.
And that's something. And that's something that. And so for those people who have the gift, we're going, well, what's wrong with you? It's right in front of you. It's natural. Let go. You know, life is glorious. You know. And I used to hate those people. I used to go, wait a minute, it's not that simple. You know, I got stuff to work through. You know, I'm dragging along a bunch of baggage here. I got to get rid of first. And so, and it's, and so, I think that's what's happening in the high end of the spiritual movement. Is that's kind of what they're doing. They're saying to the wealthy and to the people that haven't got anything else better to do than go to these retreats, they're saying, oh, you know, let go and let God and you know, and be here now and all this wonderful, glorious stuff. But these same people aren't struggling to pay their rent. They're not struggling to keep their families together. But, you know, these people, this is a little sideline entertainment they're doing. The general population is getting, I think, getting teased into a tricky place with this. That it does take a commitment. It does take conviction. It does take a shift in perspective. And it isn't as devastating and as scary as it sounds, but it is a commitment. Like any relationship that you get into, the one you're having with yourself is a commitment.
Yeah.
And it's got to be a serious one if you want it to be a successful relationship or a healing relationship. It's a commitment, and that's what I say all the time. People are lazy. You know, I mean, gets down to it. People are just lazy. They don't really want to do the work. They'd love to have the shortcut to get to the. You know, your show tonight is wholeness, breakdown, breakthrough, and integrate. The ego says, "Why can't I just be whole? Why do I got to break down? Why do I got to break through? Why can't I just be whole? Is there some shortcut I can do just to?"
Yeah. And that brings up a topic. I hope we have time in the last part of the show that I wanted to discuss specifically and get your opinion about this. But I just had a question for you, and I'm going to skim over these last two things so I can get to this one question I had for you. But so you're saying it's 3 or 4 times in a lifetime that we go through this death and rebirth?
Well, if you look at it developmentally, it certainly can be more dependent upon your life station and circumstances. But when I think of it developmentally, it's adolescence, young adult, midlife, and old age. Those are the four classic existential containers that we are supposed to move through. Many of us carry the first and second container, which is the adolescent and young adult stage, into midlife and haven't cracked those containers. In other words, we carry our adolescent beliefs or our young adult beliefs, our pain, our misery, our adversity into that midlife period and don't realize that we're not prepared for the third container, if you will, or for that third third death and rebirth experience. We haven't undergone the first two yet. That's why it sounds so intimidating. If we actually allowed ourselves to progress them as we were developing, then the third one would just be the third death and rebirth. It wouldn't be like, but I've got all this other stuff from the first two containers and it's going to be devastating and I have to, and I've got to relive this and I have to, you know, they don't understand that's not the truth, you know?
Yeah, that's a really good point. That's a really good point. And given that we go through this multiple times throughout our lifetime. So these five stages of the soul, the call, the search, the struggle, the breakthrough, and the return would be something that we would do multiple times, not just one time. Let me get this straight now. There's these five stages, and once I go through them, I'm all set. No, then you're going to have another one.
Yeah. Well, but what you're leaving out, it's kind of like, this may be a stupid example, but one time I changed the brake pads on my car. I you know, I'm not real mechanically inclined, but every so often I get real cocky and think, well, this is a manly thing to do. I'll change my own brakes. And so I spent like 3, 4, 5 hours on one wheel, and it took me 5 minutes to do the second wheel. And I think that this is it's the same thing with this. I mean, that when you go through these transitions, the first one is really hard. The first death and rebirth is probably the hardest of all because it's foreign. You don't know what to expect. You don't know what's coming. You don't know what the payoff is, what the perk is, how the changes are going to be. If you're going to have any friends left, if your family is going to reject you, if there's so many things where the ego just takes you to all these places. Once you get through it and realize that the parameter, the scope of your vision has now become more panoramic. The world looks larger. The colors of the world look richer. Your senses are heightened. Everything just seems to be better. then the next time a death and rebirth experience arrives, it doesn't, it's kind of like, oh, okay, here comes another one, you know, and you don't really know how long it's going to last or what it's going to be, and you can't control it, but you're not as intimidated by it. Mm-hmm. And so by the time you, and so if, and I'm saying this, if you allowed yourself to grow through those stages developmentally, most of us don't. The one that we're all aware of is the midlife one, because that's the one that creates, gets the most of the attention. And the only reason it gets the attention is we didn't go through the other two before the third one arrived. That's why.
Right. There was a procrastination and a putting off and,
Or it's just ignorance. I don't think we know any better. You know, the ego, I don't even think that the neurology of the brain, I don't think that the neural pathways in the brain are even ready for us to awaken until we hit 35 or 40. We're too consumed in old ways of thinking, old ways of being, and old ways of adapting that we finally have to reach a point where we go, enough already. I just want to be me.
Yeah.
And I'm going to let go. I don't care what I got to let go. I don't care what I got to do. I'm going to be me. And so there's that commitment has got to come through you, and it comes through frustration and anger and just, you know, lack of patience with how life is staying the same, but yet you know there's more. And So I think that it's a combination of many different things. And it's different for everybody how it plays out. But midlife is the one that people are the most aware of, only because the culture is aware of it.
Right. Yeah. So I'm going to kind of skim over the breakthrough and the return, but for the listeners, I'll post these definitions on my website if you want to take a look at those and become familiar with them, or even
breakthrough. Breakthrough to me means you're, well, I was going to say breakthrough. I just had a vision of a head crowning in a birth.
Yeah.
And I actually had a woman who gave me a dream where she was sitting in front of some rocks in a cave, and these snakes were crawling over her legs into the slit in the rocks, and there was this light coming through. And so she put one arm through, one shoulder, and she stuck her head through, and then she stuck her waist through, and then she popped the other side, and it was this beautiful garden with butterflies she just described coming through the cervix. And so literally that's what breaking through is.
At some
level, you're birthing. You are your own midwife in the breakthrough experience.
Right, and after the breakthrough is the return, which is returning to that place of our divine birth, right? That we've had all along.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, wow. It's ironic, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. It is. I
it
love this thing
so
called life.
Yeah.
My question
life,
for you.
What is that? When you just said life, I was going to say, what is that? Who was it that said? Was it Lenin that said life is something that happens while you're busy making plans? Is that Lenin that said that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So true.
Yes.
This question I have for you coming towards the end of our show, we might have a little bit of time to discuss it, but I'd like to do an entire show on it because I want to understand this better. And the question is, I found a website today, and this was connected to the breakdown of the part of the show. And the website is called Spiritual Emergence, and it's all about people that are being diagnosed with some kind of mental illness when there is a possibility that what they're going through is a spiritual emergency.
I
do too. And I thought of some of our top spiritual people in the spiritual arena, Eckhart Tolle, Byron Katie, I think Neil Donald Walsh. I believe all of them, I know Eckhart Tolle and Byron Katie for sure, had breakdowns before they had their major waking up into enlightenment.
I think Tolle was schizophrenic. If he wasn't diagnosed as that, I'll diagnose him that tonight because I've treated enough schizophrenics. He looks the part, and he sounds the part. And yeah. So, but schizophrenics are geniuses. Many schizophrenics are geniuses. I mean,
Yeah, so I wanted to get, you know, your professional opinion on that. You know, when you're dealing with someone and they seem so close together, like what people are experiencing in a spiritual emergency, they're kind of coming into this new world of how am I functioning without the ego leading the way? What do I do? What's going on? And your world kind of can be turned upside down. And I wonder how many people at that point are being diagnosed with some kind of mental illness when really they might need some guidance in the spiritual side of things.
Yeah. Well, there's no doubt that it's happening. I mean, I have that same kind of patient in my office all the time. And I think what you have to do is and we don't have a lot of time. We're down to like 8 or 9 minutes.
Yeah.
But I think what you have to do is you got to get a baseline on where somebody is and where somebody was before they lost their marbles, so to speak. And then now that they're finding their marbles and they're getting their marbles all back in the bag again, do they see a definition of themselves other than just this bag of marbles? People ask me all the time if they're crazy, and they already know the answer. And the better way to ask the question is, am I more than my thoughts? Because I already know my thoughts are crazy. I mean, you and I, over the course of the day, if we wrote down everything we thought and read it out loud to somebody, it is actually quite crazy.
Yeah.
And so when they're saying, am I crazy? They already know the answer to do I think crazy thoughts? We all think crazy thoughts. It's whether or not we attach to those thoughts and manifest those thoughts in some way that impairs us or that impairs others. And so I think the trick on mental illness is to get a baseline. It's almost like most of the people that are going through these emergencies, Irma, have been carrying these diagnoses around for decades. And certainly for a long time. When's the last time they got a clean slate? When's the last time that they start from a brand new place, you see? The trouble with diagnoses and mental health is that you can't shed the label. And if there's one thing I try to give people is I try to give people a brand new start and a brand new diagnosis. And the one that I give them is the easy diagnosis. And that would be their first name. You know, I say to them, do you've forgotten what your first diagnosis was? And they'll go like, really? What, bipolar? No. Well, what, schizoaffective? No, Susan. Susan was your first diagnosis. And who is she? And why is she? And what is she? And where is she? And how much time have you spent on the diagnosis of Susan? Because that's where we've, I mean, if there's anything that mental health is doing, is we're getting so far away from that now that you know, if I was going in to see a psychiatrist today and somebody called me crazy, I'd want some blood work to prove it because there's no tests. You know, there's no, yeah. I'd want blood work. I'd want a brain scan. Because I know what psychological tests are going to give me, that they'd have to take some, you know, take some saliva, blood, something that says I'm nuts because I wouldn't buy it otherwise.
Wow. That's
because
so
really
great.
When you think, yeah, well, because the truth of the matter is it's done through clinical interview, it's done through observation, it's done through some anecdotal way, and the person that is making the labeling diagnosis is supposed to be an expert at diagnosing this. Well, that would imply that he knows me in 20 minutes.
Yeah.
Or he knows me in an hour. And he may know the symptoms of what insanity and craziness is and all these different kinds of things, but he doesn't know me.
Yeah,
and we already know now that that same patient can walk into 7 different doctors and get 7 different diagnoses. I mean, that's what happens. And so, right. If I was a person that was trying to find if I am in a spiritually emerging place, but yet I have a history of psychiatric or psychological issues, I try to make a distinction between where that stops and starts and where my spiritual emerging stops and starts. and see if I can strike some balance. I don't know if that's a good answer to your question, but
that makes so much sense. That makes so much sense.
Yeah.
And what a blessing you are to your patients.
Well, I'm saying, I don't know if I got the short answer on that. The short answer is get a new baseline.
Yeah.
Start over, get a new baseline. You know, start over with a brand new doctor, a brand new place, a brand new approach, and don't carry your history and your baggage in the door with you and see if they can diagnose you.
Yeah.
Because what typically happens is they reach out and grab the old diagnosis. See, I don't want to see people's records. I don't want to see people's history before I meet them. I want to form my own opinion.
Wow, what a gift.
And I can generally tell whether or not they've got a psychiatric kind of underlying problem, or if it's a psychological spiritual problem. I make that distinction very, very quickly. And many people who think they're crazy are not. Many people that think they're depressed and anxious, they certainly are depressed and anxious, but they don't know why. Some doctor said it's because they're a little bit crazy.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I've got a little bit of an attitude about that.
and bringing that balance of the human and the divine together, and where they're working in partnership, and it sounds like that's something you offer your patients, and what a gift and what a blessing that you're giving people, Ernie.
Well, thank you for that. But I will say that we all walk around with our own personal religion. And what is that? It's a set of beliefs that we think is law.
And so what
we're supposed to do at some point is really reanalyze and rethink those beliefs. And so you don't have to be in a dogmatic religion or in an organized religion to be stuck in your own personal religion, which is some false idea of who you are. And that is what people call crazy making, you know,
when you don't ever reflect.
You never reflect yourself. So, well, thank you, Irma, so much. We're down to 2 minutes, 3 minutes.
Oh, well, thank you, Ernie. I've enjoyed this. I think especially this last part here, I think a lot of clarity has been created for our listeners. And I, for some reason, it's totally left my head what our topic is for next week. I don't know.
That's okay. Something wonderful. That's all they need to know.
Yeah. And yeah. Would you like to tell the listeners where they can reach you, Ernie?
Yes. It's just my name. That's ErnieVecchio.com. And the work that I do is intentional guided evolution. In addition to just doing rehabilitation, psychology, I also do spiritual or psycho-spiritual work with people, consultations and whatever. So, yeah, that's my website.
Okay, well, thank you. And I actually created an email for the show, and it's very simply, thanks to a friend of mine who suggested this, it's very simply talktoirma@gmail.com. So you can email me with any questions or just to chat.
Fabulous.
And thank you so much, Ernie, and I will talk to you next week. And listeners, have a wonderful, wonderful week.
Night, Irma.
Good night, Ernie.